This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you so much for starting off your day and your week with us right here on the Morning Run on BFM 89.9. I am Tan Chung Han, and with me is
Brian Fernandez here. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, folks. Brian, had a good weekend?
Yes, I did, actually. A combination of a little bit of a relaxed weekend and also going out a little bit more than usual.
Oh, a little bit more than usual. Look at you, you party animal there. All right, so just to give you a heads up, so the Morning Run, as always, goes on till 10 a.m. every weekday, unless if it's a public holiday, of course. Here's what we've got in store for you on this Monday, October 2nd. How about this? First business day of the fourth quarter of the year. How time flies. So coming up on the Breakfast Grill today, which happens after the 8 a.m. news bulletin, we'll be speaking to Bruce Gale, author of the book titled Economic Reform in Malaysia, The Contribution of Najibnomics. Brian, are you familiar with the term Najibnomics?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm looking forward to that particularly, Han. And in terms of all the controversy surrounding those comments and how some people perceived it to be perhaps instigated by the powers that be, it'll be interesting to see what he has to say and what your takeaways are from that interview later at 8 o'clock.
All right, so that's the Breakfast Grill again coming up after the 8 a.m. news bulletin. Between now and then, we've also got a roundup of the local newspapers' cover stories, also what's happening in the global markets. We'll be speaking to Kingsley Jones, founder and chief investment officer at Jevons Global in Sydney. So that's among the lineup that we have for you between now and 10 a.m. today. Also, here are some headlines as we kick off the week. The region of Catalonia in Spain held its independence referendum that was done on Sunday, and it turned violent. Over 800 people were injured as police cracked down on that referendum, which Spain's prime minister has said that it was illegal. Have you been following this referendum at all?
Not a lot, but I mean, from what I understand, the people in the region have always been fiercely independent. Mm. This referendum was intended to push the agenda a little bit forward, but I think it's turned ugly, unfortunately.
Yeah, 844 people injured, given the police crackdown. Also, still in Europe, two women were killed in Marseille, France, by a knife-wielding man. Local authorities are treating this as a case of terrorism. So once again, highlighting the very real threat of terrorism that European nations are facing right now.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate that they were 17 and 20, and it was quite violent. One was stabbed in the stomach, the other one had a throat slit.
All right. Also, U.S. President Donald Trump once again giving us some headlines there, ramping up geopolitical concerns. Over the weekend, he told U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to not waste his time with talking to North Korea about its nuclear program, once again issuing some rather controversial statements via his official Twitter account. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be discussing about, now that we are here on a Monday and we just had a weekend, and I don't know how much downtime you have. After the break, we'll be discussing about the merits of having some downtime and doing nothing. All that coming up after this one by Neil Young, Hey Hey, My My, here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Hey Hey, My My by Neil Young here on the Morning Run. Hey Hey, My My, it's the first business day of the final quarter of 2017, and it is a Monday. Hopefully that song can help you cure some of your Monday blues. And hopefully over the weekend, you were able to waste some time. So there's an article on Quartz, that's QZ.com, that carried the line, and I quote, "Wasted time is in fact highly fulfilling and necessary." So, I mean, I don't know about you, Brian. Do you believe in wasting time?
No,
counterintuitive, right?
No, I think that the thing is, let's live such productive lives in general during the week, especially during the weekend. I like to take some time out and do stuff that may seem really stupid, boring, and really a waste of time. Like, for example, going to the park. So or some people call it my cycling, waste of time. But what it does is really helps you to relax your mind. A lot of times when I do these long bike rides, for example, seems like a waste of time with a whole bunch of guys and girls. But while trying to relax, it actually gives me really the best ideas and all that that I have, because you know your mind is such a relaxed state. You're very receptive to external stimuli.
Well, now that's interesting that you framed it that way, because that shows an underlying bias whereby we still have to be productive even when doing these activities. Though you mentioned when you cycle, you then have to come up with ideas and whatnot. Whereas this article suggests that we just need to detach and just do nothing. When we were discussing this article before coming on air, we had colleagues who spoke about how weekends are just filled with family commitments, tending to the kids, meeting up with friends, and making up for lost time that you perhaps didn't have over the week. But still, there is this underlying motive to be productive, and I think that's what this article is talking about, whether or not we constantly have to be productive, whether or not there has to be this end result, regardless of the activity that we are partaking in.
But you see, one of the things that really you need to work on, I think, is a digital or semi-digital detox during the weekends, because we are so obsessed with keeping up to date, up to the minute, up to the second. One of the things that I do to help, which is a semi-digital detox, because I don't answer emails until like Sunday night or sometimes even
that
Monday
explains
mornings.
A lot there, buddy. No wonder you're not picking up my calls.
Okay. But it really helps you to relax your mind. While I do all these other activities, not obsessing over what's happening in Facebook or the emails that the 201 emails that you get per day really helps you to relax. Mm.
And so again, going back to this article, it talks about this looming awareness of the things that we should be doing and while we waste or we while away time, right? And I think another question here to consider is, where did we get these this inherent sense of having to be productive, having to produce these results, be it say, oh, I read X number of books this year, or I went on so many trips this year, right? There's always, there appears to be this quantifiable goal in mind when we go about these activities.
Yeah, because the thing is, it's all, our society is all so results driven.
Do you think it started off in school? Like, that's where we learn, to kind of frame our activities in this way?
I think no, it came much, for me, it probably came much later in life. I think when you enter the corporate world and, everything is, what's your KPI, your time, especially when I was working in consulting, it's basically your time is measured in terms of dollars and cents, because that's your output, right? So that's when that whole obsession with working round the clock and 24 hours really came about. I think I started to see that. And really the rise of the internet has really pushed that agenda for, in terms of being available, always connected, all the time.
There we go. And therein lies that trade-off, right? Because if you take time away from, tending to emails and chats, and in this hyper-competitive, hyper-connected world that we live in, you're expected almost to respond immediately, right? To WhatsApps, to emails, et cetera, right? So I think I think the trade-off here would be, if you do not partake in that digital detox that you spoke about, then you're seen perhaps as being less productive. You may not be as as attentive or as responsive as compared to your colleagues, and that could come at some or at some real cost, perhaps a promotion or something, right?
Yeah, and you're right about that, because haven't we heard of entrepreneurs or CEOs contacting their staff at 3 a.m. in the morning and expecting them to respond.
And it doesn't happen here at BFM, for the record.
We've got a great boss, by the way.
So just want to make sure we get our bonuses, but yes. All right, so coming up in just a bit, we'll also be, in speaking about downtime activities, we'll consider this notion, whether or not the fitness industry has gone too far. That's coming up in just a bit, right here on BFM 89.9. Modern English there with I Melt With You. This is the Morning Run here on BFM 89.9. I am Tan Chung Han and with me is
Brian Fernandez.
Hi, good morning, folks. So I wonder how many of you are actually working out right now or perhaps planning to work out after, you know, making your school runs and whatnot. I mean, Brian, I know you're a fitness fanatic.
I don't consider myself a fanatic, but I know the value of good fitness.
Oh, how about that? Okay, way to quantify that then. So you've got this article on The Guardian questioning whether or not our obsession with fitness has gone too far. So it essentially talks about, you know, how in this age where we've got, you know, gym classes, like 24-hour gyms, and, you know, so many instructors that are offering their fitness advice for free on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, etc. You know, where do we draw this line?
Now, the thing is, so it's quite interesting that you said that a lot of fitness enthusiasts actually get information online. And these Instagram guys who dish out this information, a lot of times we have no idea whether or not they're qualified. So if you're in a gym, really, chances are if it's a properly certified gym, your instructors are all properly trained and properly certified. Mm. Now, if you get advice that you want to basically implement on your own at home, that could be potentially very, very dangerous.
Well, I think it's beyond just the unregulated aspect of these fitness instructors, and I'm using air quotes there, but it's this idea that our fitness regimes are just getting more intense, more extreme. You've got the CrossFits, you know. I mean, it's no longer just about taking a leisurely jog around your neighborhood. Now you're flipping, you know, truck tires, and, you know, like handling weights. I even saw this ad on the Wall Street Journal. I mean, as if yoga isn't hard enough, they now have classes where you do yoga on a pedal board. So, you know, where do you draw the line, or how much more extreme do we have to get here?
No, I think it's, again, back to that whole competitive spirit that we have right now. So if you're doing that, I want to do something
there
a little
we go.
Bit better.
Right? And to what end, though? Like, next thing you know, we're all signing up for boot camps and everyone's, you know, a soldier in the army or something.
But here's the thing that I always worried about, and I always tell people who want to start a fitness regime, the first thing you actually need to do, and people don't do this, is really go and get make a visit to the doctor to see what your current situation with your health is. You need a situation analysis, just like any business. What is the state of your body? And then a fitness practitioner, you can go online and find that out. But based on that, if you're fit enough or your health checks give you the green light, then you can go and do whatever you want, but very, very incrementally.
Well, since we are a business station, let's give you some numbers here. So the 2017 UK State of the Fitness Industry report shows that the sector is worth almost £5 billion annually, and it's seen a 6% growth compared to 2016. So certainly a lot more people jumping on the bandwagon, both literally and figuratively. And, you know, do we keep doing this until we all keel over and die or something?
And speaking of
obviously, I'm not a fitness fanatic here.
But Han, speaking of the fitness industry, you'd be surprised to know there are fitness trainers in Malaysia, in KL, Klang Valley right now, charging 200 to 250 ringgit per hour for training.
Wow. Well, perhaps something to consider for our weekend gigs then, all right? It's 26 minutes past 6 a.m. on Monday, October 2nd. We'll be back with more right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is the Morning Run. That was A Little Time by Beautiful South. Good morning, I am Tan Chung Han, and with me in the studio is
Brian Fernandez.
Good morning, guys. All right, so this is article on BBC.com. You know, once again, giving us an update on the spaceship, at least that's a term that has often been used to describe Apple's new office over there in California, Cupertino, I believe. The headline of the article reads, "The Rise of the Multi-Billion-Dollar Corporate Campus." You know, and given this kind of lavish spending on their HQs, one wonders whether there's a practical reason for this massive structure, or is it just mainly to serve, you know, some oversized corporate egos?
So here's the thing, Han, and that Apple campus, just to give our listeners a perspective, is $5 billion. So that's 22 billion ringgit for a basically a large office building. But large corporate campuses and flagship campuses like this are not something that's new. In fact, AT&T, with its Bell Labs, started this whole concept really in the 50s on and companies like GE on how basic their staff could eat, work, play and relax really in the same place.
But what happened to working remotely, for example? And you would think that that $5 billion could have been, you know, spent perhaps helping them with rent. We know that rent over there, you know, in certain parts of California is just sky high and nosebleed territory. You know, so one wonders really, you know, again, beyond the symbolic or cultural stature of such a massive building, you know, again, is there really a practicality behind it? You know, what happened to working from home?
So I think it's a combination of things. Studies have found that basically when you get people to stay longer at the office and it doesn't feel like work, they tend to be A, more productive, B, the lines between work and living are blurred. So this is why, for example,
that can be good for our well-being. They're
not
trying to trick us into
not
working more.
It's about squeezing more productivity out of you. So that's why in all these Silicon Valley campuses, which are then adopted throughout the world, really, you have rest areas for you to have naps, to essentially you have cafeterias that are free-flowing of food. That all seem really counterintuitive. Why are you giving away all the free stuff? But really, it's to suck you in.
Well, and this is totally in contrast to what we were speaking about just now, the importance of detaching, right, and almost wasting time, not having to engage in productive activities all the time. And yet, you've got the likes of Apple, and also I believe Amazon is also on the hunt for a new city for their large mammoth HQ as well. You know, so, and with the idea of, like you say, or as you claim, trying to suck out as much productivity from you, I think, you know, as workers, as employees of the world, it's, I think, something that we have to be aware of, eh? Like, not get sucked in literally to these fancy buildings and, you know, see it for what it is.
But Han, let's take the flip side of the equation. Particularly if you're a young employee, you don't have family, you don't have children and commitments like that, hanging out with your work buddies, who then become, because you spend most of your time with them, they become your friends as well.
True. And then, some might even call them family.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. That's your extended family. So it's fun hanging out on campus, working, collaborating with your friends, eating free food, taking free buses, getting free massages. That's all very seductive.
Yeah, but I can't help but feel like these, you know, mega employers are pulling a fast one over their employees, and, you know, by way of offering these free massages and meals and whatnot. I mean, come on, like, you know, you would, well, I mean, well, go ahead, yes.
But Han, one of the key things is also this is a talent attraction strategy. You know,
are talent really attracted to like these fancy buildings?
Yeah, I'm sure, because, you know, it's a sense of pride. I work for Apple, for example.
Well, the company name aside, yes, but it's the actual physical infrastructure, though, like that physical building. Because now you've got a lot of companies, especially startups, who are moving into, say, shared spaces or industrial areas, repurposing, you know, old abandoned factories. So that's got a cooler vibe, right, as opposed to this spaceship that Apple is building for $5 billion.
Well, you're right and you're wrong. I think it appeals to a different individual, but then this is a large corporate, and to attract engineers from, say, the likes of Facebook and Google, you've got to do something different.
Well, I will say this, though. I did visit the Facebook campus over there in California just a couple of years ago. I wouldn't mind a gig over there. It's quite a sweet place to work. Although it was like this large factory area, though. You can just walk on for miles. It's crazy. All right. We've got more right here on The Morning Run coming up after these messages here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Jimi Hendrix there with Hey Joe. And you are listening to The Morning Run, Han and Brian with you. Wouldn't you have loved to see Jimi Hendrix, the great Jimi Hendrix, live in concert?
Actually, that would be quite a performance, I'm sure.
I would give an arm and a leg and maybe even a kidney as well, though, to do that. I don't know about that.
You're such a big fan, huh?
Well, I'm a fan. I am a former guitar player. Unfortunately, the commitments of the present day prevent me from indulging in some guitar playing. But now, unfortunately, definitely pop music fans here in Malaysia perhaps having to travel abroad more often to catch their favorite acts. You've got organizers of pop concerts and some other big events who are increasingly wary of including Malaysia on their itineraries. So we spoke to Iqbal Amir, the CEO of events company The Livescape Group, and we asked him what factors do international artists take into account when choosing where to perform.
Well, in the past 7 years that Livescape has operated, we've always realized that artists take into account stability. They want to make sure that the market that they enter, it's a stable market, it's got a good fan base, and it has a history of successful events. And when we say successful events, we mean that the shows actually get put on.
And Iqbal also tells us whether the guidelines for these artists, whether they are clear enough.
To be honest, I think our guidelines are actually now fairly clear. Livescape has a great relationship with PUSPAL, which is the authority when it comes to approving artists that come to the country. We actually spend a very, very long time lobbying with artists and getting them to understand the nature of how Malaysia is and what restrictions there are. Compared to maybe 3 years ago, artists are more receptive into following the guidelines as they penetrate new markets. But that does not take into account on whether the artist wants to do the show in the country in the first place.
Again, that's Iqbal Amir, the CEO of Livescape Group, which organizes live events across Malaysia. Now, we also wanted to find out just how competitive is Malaysia as a location compared to Thailand and Singapore.
The issue right now is Malaysia does not have a good reputation. So when we don't have a good reputation when it comes to putting on live shows, because of there are too many variables at play when it comes to putting on a show, what happens is that the market becomes soft. Participants, people or fans that want to go for concert, they start to get very wary, you know, is the concert going to happen or not? And they actually have to look sure that the promoter is reputable enough, has a history of putting on concerts in order to make sure that it happens. Places like Thailand or Singapore, which have shows every other week, has a long-standing history of the shows actually happening. So, you know, it's a safer bet.
So, of course, we then have to ask the question, what can be done to improve our reputation?
It's about assurances. And assurances have to come from the public and private sector. So if the government sets a mandate and goes, we intend to ensure that the live entertainment industry in Malaysia is strong and we will support it, you know. I don't even mean financial support. I mean just support the scene, you know. And it gives everybody the confidence from sponsors to Malaysians. But somebody has to set the tone and, you know, we take directive from the government. So as long as government makes that mandate, then it becomes a lot more attractive for promoters to go, okay, you know, I'm going to risk it and I'm going to try and do this show. Because everything's been very murky, you know, we don't have a straight line in terms of what is the direction when it comes to live entertainment. When that happens, that's why promoters are forced to look elsewhere for their rice bowl. Livescape has set up an office in Singapore, and this year we've set up an office in Jakarta just to make sure that we spread our risk correctly.
That was Iqbal Amir, the CEO of events company, The Livescape Group, talking about the challenges when trying to organize and roll out a live event, concert, pop concerts and what have you here in Malaysia. And when you consider his comments in light of, say, Coldplay concerts that were held in Thailand and Singapore, totally skipping past Malaysia. I believe the similar thing happened with Foo Fighters. So whether or not Malaysian pop, concert goers, fans of live concerts, they are having to actually take their money elsewhere, you know, due to these murky situation as Iqbal describes them.
Well, you see, the thing is, it's a much broader picture than that, Han. It's not just the event itself, but it's also the event's ability to attract and provide entertainment for our visitors. Now, Malaysia is on this push about tourism. So we're supposed to have 31.5 billion tourists coming in. They need to have something to do, something to look forward to, something interesting that stands out from other markets. If we don't have quality entertainment shows like this coming in from all over the world, we're going to lose out. We're just, this is another aspect of enhancing our appeal as a tourism destination.
Well, what about the cultural sensitivities that the authorities, you know, often, you know, use as the trump card, right? When saying that, oh, event ABC should not be held here. Why? Because it goes against the Malaysian cultural sensitivities, however you define them, right? So shouldn't there be this push and pull discussion here, whereby it's not just mass appeal, it's not just about dollars and cents, but it's also what's congruent with the Malaysian story, so to speak?
I think we have to be sensitive to that, of course. But the bigger picture is, I think the artists now realize as well, they have their sensitivities. Are we being overly sensitive? That's what I think the question is.
All right, so there's the economics of it and also the cultural or socio-political aspects to having a live concert here in Malaysia. What a complex story there. We've got the 7 a.m. news bulletin coming up in just a bit. But first, here's the Chemical Brothers with Let Forever Be here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Han and Brian here in the studio. You're tuned into the Morning Run. It's Monday, October 2nd, 6 minutes past 7 a.m. So now, yesterday, Sunday, October 1st, the Prime Minister, Dato Sri Najib Tun Razak, announced a 5 million ringgit allocation to boost the welfare of MACC officers. Now, on top of that, there are plans afoot for yet another government department to focus on integrity efforts. So you've got the National Integrity and Good Governance Department, or known by its Malay acronym, JITN, which will focus on policy matters and trying to, you know, transform the civil service in terms of integrity, good governance, human rights compliance, etc. Now, we spoke to Cynthia Gabriel, Executive Director of the Welfare-Based Group, C4, that's the Center to Combat Corruption and Cronyism. We asked her views on whether we needed another integrity department, given that Malaysia already has several bodies devoted to this issue.
Yeah, well, we are of the opinion that what is really needed in terms of reform is to strengthen the independence of the current existing institutions, not to create another department within the executive. So the integrity department does not come across very convincingly as something that is necessary and required at this current point in time. What is required now is independent institutions that are needed to promote and protect public interest. And this is what is really lacking, especially when the institutions are tasked to take on high-level people in the political leadership and actually investigating any malfeasance or wrongdoing that could take place, and as a result of it, compromise the integrity and the culture of the civil service and the integrity of the country as a whole. We need independent institutions. We need the MACC to be far more independent than it is.
Following the announcement of JITN's plans for JITN to be formed, there were comments from Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Dato' Paul Low, who is spearheading this effort. And he says that JITN is not a mechanism to supervise the MACC. He said, and I quote, "Because the emphasis on transformation and preventive side is done by JITN, so in a sense, it does relieve enforcement agencies to concentrate on their enforcement side." And Cynthia then provides her take on those comments by Dato' Paul.
So I do think there is a point in what the Chief Commissioner of the MACC had said previously, that what is actually needed is to improve the independence of the MACC, to improve their enforcement capabilities, and to improve the skills and workforce of the current commission. The point about the integrity department, which is part of the executive under the Prime Minister's department, monitoring the MECC, is in itself a very troubling concept. What we need is the executive not to interfere, and I repeat, not to interfere in the investigations of the MECC, especially if the MACC is investigating the top levels of the political leadership in the country. So the issue here is that the integrity department within the Prime Minister's department should not be the one to monitor MECC's performance, but it should be an independent unit that could be set up, like another ombudsman's unit or a select committee within the parliament that would look at how MECC performs and whether MECC is actually carrying out its work without fear and without favour. So the very concept that Minister Paul Lau is advocating here is not supporting and it is not assisting the need for greater separation of powers. In fact, it is trying to exert even more control from the executive, and that is certainly not what is required at this point in time.
And finally, we ask her views on the criticism that the new department will only incur unnecessary costs, costs that could be channeled back to existing enforcement agencies.
We ask the question of where will these funds come from, because all the other commissions and departments seem to be getting a budget cut and allocations cut down from their existing work. So by the argument of budget allocations alone, Minister Paul Lau must really answer to the question of what really is the need of this department at this current point in time, because it's going to require more public funds to support it and it's going to require greater efforts to keep the bureaucracy of this unit running over time.
And that was Cynthia Gabriel, Executive Director of the Center to Combat Corruption and Cronyism, otherwise known as C4.
You know, Hans, Cynthia has brought up a lot of valid points. So one of the things she brought up is really about the oversight aspect. If you are not having something that is separate from the executive oversight of MECC, if you're having oversight that separates it, then there's some value add. This is not the case. The second thing is also the fact that why are we adding another layer of bureaucracy with the cost issues, but with no real visible outcomes then moving forward?
Well, you know, I think that's to be debated what the outcomes of this JITN, or at least this proposed mechanism, would be. You know, obviously, they're still in a position right now where they're still trying to define the various jurisdictions. You know, you got Paul Lau again saying that JITN is not going to supervise the MACC. But you're right. No, obviously, these extra initiatives do incur a cost, and it will ultimately be the taxpayers who then have to pay this burden. But I think the discussion should also follow on, even if, and this is a big if here, JITN and MACC do really carry out their enforcement tasks to the best of their ability, you know, their, and we have seen a lot of headlines, right, of MACC nabbing some corrupt officials and whatnot, but whether or not it will gain some real traction in the sentiment, you know, on the ground, especially among us Malaysians, given that corruption, you know, appears to be so entrenched into, you know, the way we do things around here.
Yeah, because you see, Han, you're right. It's part of the trust deficit that we have, because the man on the street, or the lady on the street for that matter, does not see, they see basically MACC doing their job, nabbing these and highlighting these problems. But then from a prosecution standpoint, there seems to be a little bit of a delay. You don't see enough people actually going to jail and so forth. That really adds to the trust deficit that's out there.
But it's a long process, though, and we must appreciate the complexity of the tasks at hand, though, like be it the Securities Commission or even LHDN for that matter, or the MACC, whereby, you know, going through the legal process is quite tedious. But anyways, I mean, going back to the matter at hand here, you know, whether or not JITN, got to get used to them there, again, if they come about, JITN, whether or not they are necessary, you know, at what cost, and whether or not there could be a conflict of interest here, especially in light of that 5 million ringgit donation that the Prime Minister has just given to MACC. Ultimately, who is MACC accountable to? I think that's the question that we have to keep at the forefront of our minds as we follow this story. It's now 15 minutes past 7 a.m. on Monday, October 2nd. Coming up in just a bit, we'll look at the front pages of the local newspapers right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.